facilities, including shelter, water and sanitation, education and health care.
When the emergency began last month, Spindler says the UNHCR emptied its warehouse in the city of Peshawar and distributed tents, plastic sheets, blankets and kitchen sets to tens of thousands of people. He says the stock is now being replenished. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
The Chinese government is ready to launch its third group of astronauts into space. China says the crew of the Shenzhou 7 will take off from a remote desert area sometime tomorrow. The mission will also feature a spacewalk by one astronaut. It is not yet clear how long the mission will last. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org.
The Member Match Fund. Think of it as seed money to grow a larger base of support for WILL. I'm station manager Jay Pierce, asking you to send a check to WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, 61801, or give online at willpledge.org, and we'll use your contribution for the Member Match Fund to kick off our fall radio pledge drive with a power hour Thursday, October 16th. Give now and encourage others to follow your lead. Thanks.
Today's programs are made possible with support from the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, educating consumers about their rights as patients since 1977. The Healthcare Consumers is a proud member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll deduction at work, on the web at cs-il.org. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from REMAX Realty Associates, experienced full-time professional agents listing and selling homes in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. REMAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. One of the biggest challenges faced by communities recovering from natural disaster is the need for housing. And in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with the co-founder of an organization that works to provide architectural solutions for humanitarian crises. And our guest is Kate Storr. She is Managing Director of Architecture for Humanity. We'll tell you more of the history of the organization, but just basically it began with a competition to build housing for refugees returning to Kosovo. And in the years since, the group has been involved in projects all over the world, and among them reconstruction efforts after the South Asian tsunami of 2004 and also Hurricane Katrina. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. All you have to do to be a part of the conversation is to pick up the telephone and dial the number. And that is 333-9455. That's the number for folks here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. But if you happen to be listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the internet, you may use the toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Kate Storr, is a former journalist. She is co-editor of the book Design Like You Give a Damn and has served as a panel moderator and guest speaker at a number of design conferences and events, including a series at the New York Public Library, live from NYPL, the Aspen Ideas Festival, Structures for Inclusion, and the Chicago Architecture Foundation. She has a bachelor's degree from New York University, master's degree in journalism from Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. Ms. Storr, hello.
Morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. You and you?
Good.
I'm glad that you could be talking with us. And I really, I want to, you know, as we talk here, I'm sure that we'll talk about some of the things that are in the book. But I just, I want to again mention to people, if you're looking for a concrete examples of the kinds of things that we are talking about, that's what people will find in the book. And I think it's a, not only is it a really snappy piece of graphic design, but just to see the photographs of all of these various things, temporary shelter, permanent shelter, all sorts of things that different ideas people have had about providing a shelter for people who have come through emergencies and wars and natural disasters. I really think that it's a fascinating book. So I would certainly people who are interested in architecture and design and urban planning, those kind of fields, would find this interesting. But I think it's just fascinating to look at all of the various ideas and see what people have done using unconventional techniques and maybe unconventional materials.
Yeah, it's like Dwell Magazine in reverse.
kind of. Well, that's that sort of gets at the idea that I think probably when people think about architects and what architects do, or at least they think about the kind of architecture that gets attention in the mainstream media, it is the work of very well-known architects, very high-profile architects, and it's going to be big projects, big public buildings, big commercial buildings, maybe exceptional residences, the kinds of things that that do get written up in architecture magazines. This is something completely different. And I wouldn't want to make it sound like the architecture profession is, all they're interested in is making money. That would be very, very unfair. But this is a kind of approach to shelter design that we don't, I just don't think we hear very much or think very much about.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why we wrote Design Like You Give a Damn. We were sort of getting started to do this work, and this is going on six, seven years now. And we noticed that there were all these incredibly talented, beautiful architects working all over the world who were doing these projects, frankly, for the love of it. And they weren't getting covered in the architecture press, and there wasn't any place you could go to learn about how to do this work or the history of the work. And so we ended up writing Design Like You Give a Damn, and in the process learned a whole lot about how to do our jobs, right? So I think the best way to get better at your own job is to write about other people.
Tell us about how Architecture for Humanity got started.
I think you summed it up. We were watching TV. I mean, we were just watching TV one night. Cameron, my partner, is an architect, and I'm a journalist. And seeing the refugees returning to Kosovo, this is after the war, and they were coming home. Their homes were in rubble. Winter was coming. And Cameron, who was an architect, looked at this and said, this is an architectural problem. We need to figure out how to build transitional housing or repurpose these homes so that people can be sheltered for the winter. And actually, it's kind of funny because his first thought is, I'm just going to go out there and design something and go to Kosovo and hopefully build it maybe. And he called a couple of people. He called the United Nations, UNHCR. And UNHCR, first of all, is lovely. They're an amazing group, and were incredibly helpful. And then he called Bob Ivey at Architecture Record. And Bob, who's the editor there, turned to him and he said, this is great, but you've done commercial offices in New York City and high-end retail, and what do you know about refugee situations in Kosovo? And Cameron sort of said, okay, yeah, you've got a point. And so I was a web producer at the time, and together we hosted an online competition to design the transitional housing. And the thought was, well, if we don't know, someone's going to know. And in fact, some Serbian architects entered, and their design was incredible. And they included a note that said, it's not us who are doing this, it's our leaders. And it was really moving. We were in a 400-square-foot apartment, and FedEx truck showed up the morning of the entries were due, and it was all entries. And trust me, there's a picture of our apartment completely chock-a-block. We almost had to move the bed out and all the furniture to fit all the boards. But yeah, that's how it started.
So here we're talking about something that the constraints are, it's something that has to be inexpensive to put up. It has to be something that can be put up relatively quickly and easily without a lot of high-tech tools and big construction equipment. And it's got to be the kind of thing that I guess you can literally put in some kind of box or some kind of container so that then you can ship it, you can transport it to the place where you want to send it up, set it up, and then it's got to be something that, again, can be set up relatively quickly, relatively easily, and if you're trying to house a large number of people, each individual structure, it's got to be really cost-effective. And I suppose then on top of that, if you're concerned with sustainability issues, you'd also like it to be something that, to the extent that you could, was green in all respects. That seems like that's a pretty tall order.
Yes, it is. Transitional housing is emergency housing and transitional housing, I should say, because they're a little bit different. It's all about logistics. You're not making a traditional shelter in the way we think about shelter. You're actually making a product. And it's got to be less than $400 to $600. It has to be shipped in a container. And when you unpack it, all the pieces have to be together. So we did a field test of a shelter called GV Shelters, which is actually an incredible design. It's recycled fire-retardant cardboard, essentially, and it makes this sort of temporary house. So we shipped it off to the Grenada, but in the first pass at the design, they had designed the roof structure so that it packs separately from the wall structure, and there's this great picture of our poor clients in Grenada after Hurricane Ivan, and, you know, you can see they're standing inside four walls without a roof, right? So the reason was that the shipment got split, and so all the walls arrived and none of the roofs. It took us a couple more days to get the roofs there. So you have to be thinking, when you're designing about how the stuff is going to get packed and shipped, you have to be thinking about cost. And you do have to be thinking about sustainability. You don't want to, for example, one of the problems with tarp is that people cut down nearby forests to create the supporting structure for the tarp. And you have a lot of deforestation after disaster often because they're looking for structural members for temporary housing. Okay. So thinking about how you can either prevent that by using another material or repurpose those structural members in permanent housing so that at least that deforestation is not in vain.
If you had need for a structure like this, you know, say I'm an international relief organization and I'm going to be going someplace where there has been a disaster, and I know that there are a lot of people who have lost their homes, and we got to provide, say, temporary shelter for them really quickly. Is there some place that I can go? Is there some catalog? Are there many? Because you said essentially what you're doing is you're designing a product. Are there many off products that are available right now on the shelf? Options for that I could just call somebody and said, look, I need 100 of these, or 1,000 of these, or 5,000 of these.
Yeah, you know, I wish there were the IKEA of emergency housing, right? I mean, we need it.
Yeah.
We do.
Yeah.
We need it. Yeah. Actually, when the Pakistan earthquake hit in Kashmir about three years ago now, wow. The interesting thing about that is Pakistan is where a lot of the tents are manufactured. And their supplies were completely run down by Hurricane Katrina, which had happened 3 weeks before, and by the tsunami, which had happened the year before, and they had never really recovered their inventory. So when the disaster struck them, they ended up using billboards. They took down the billboards, the plastic sheeting from the billboards, and used that as tenting. So you get really dependent on these supply chains and on logistics. And what we're trying to do is encourage people to stockpile smart structures that aren't going to degrade and have them on supply and have people trained in how to actually implement these structures, because it's no good to have a really great transitional structure that people erect incorrectly and therefore it doesn't work, or that people don't understand how to use, or that gets stuck in a warehouse somewhere and nobody ever actually really even learns about. I mean, that's even the worst of all scenarios. So it's an ongoing battle to get people to think about the disaster that lies ahead. I think that people are, I don't want to say complacent, but they tend not to spend money in places where they don't see an immediate need, and then, of course, it's too late. You can't put together a transitional housing program after a disaster. It takes too long. We saw what happened in Hurricane Katrina.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Kate Storr. She is Managing Director of Architecture for Humanity. If you're interested in finding out about this group and what they're all about, you should go to their website, which is architectureforhumanity.org. You can also take a look at the book, which she co-edited, that's titled Design Like You Give a Damn. The subtitle is Architectural Responses to Humanitarian Crises. And the book is published by Metropolis Books and shows examples of the kinds of things that we're talking about. Everything from temporary emergency shelter, something that literally is a tent, through kind of things that are more in the middle where you might have people living for a while, to then more permanent structures, and the kinds of solutions that designers and architects have come up with, people doing this kind of thing all over the world, sometimes using, as I said, unconventional techniques and materials to produce a lot of really innovative structures to provide housing to people who, for whatever reason, whether we're talking about the dislocations of war or natural disaster, have lost their homes. It's very, very interesting. So you might take a look at, if you have the opportunity, go out and see if you can find this book, Design Like You Give a Damn. Also, you can look at the website architectureforhumanity.org, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's someone to talk with in Sharon Champaign, where we are. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
First of all, your guest has a wonderful sense of humor and an interesting story to tell. What about Katrina? Did they manage to do anything there? I guess I'll make a comment. She also mentioned we tend to be too short-term in terms of, we don't think in terms of long-term, I mean, certainly United States. And what they did was they, had those trailers with formaldehyde and all that kind of stuff, and the way I look at it was probably some corruption that was there in terms of these trailers and how it was done and all that kind of stuff. So I'd like to hear what she would have to say about that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. We after Hurricane Katrina, I'll just a short disclaimer. We had learned a lot about transitional housing in other disasters, and we decided to focus on reconstruction, which I'd love to talk about with you. But in terms of transitional housing, the after the storm, people were saying that Americans would not live in tents, that they needed better accommodation, that Americans didn't want to sort of quote-unquote camp on their property. And the emphasis was on getting trailers to the region, not even to the communities, because people felt that this is the standards to which Americans wanted to live. It had air conditioning and all these things. And then, the American government, being what it is, and I can talk to you about the procurement process because we actually went into bid on a contract with USAID, which is not too different. But they don't want to do hundreds or even thousands of contracts. They want to do one contract. And in this particular disaster, given the scale of the disaster, that to me was the single greatest tragedy, that we cannot figure out how to eliminate the bureaucracy in this digital era to do what needed to be done, which was 1,000 different contracts with local communities on the Gulf Coast saying, here is some funding for temporary and transitional housing. It is up to you how you spend it. Instead, what happened is the FEMA earmarked it turned out to be hundreds of millions for trailers, went into contract with them, and there is no accountability. There is no way that one agency quickly can ensure that all of those trailers get distributed to the site. And it took them about 2 years, I kid you not, 2 years to finally get even a working system. And even then it was somewhat broken. I mean, my staff, we were building housing at that point, and our clients were still waiting for their FEMA trailers to come. So I think that if they had thought about it, and I know there was a lot of fraud after the disaster, and we can talk about what your tolerance is for fraud, but if they had just trusted local community groups, local neighborhood associations, even local government in a sense, there would have been some accountability. People who were accountable would have been saying, hey, we are residents. We do not have trailers. We're going to cancel this contract unless you can figure out how to get them here. So that's number one. And I think that's unique to America. I'm probably going on too long. There may be other questions, but you could talk forever about Hurricane Katrina, but that was the biggest problem there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, all right, thanks. Other questions are welcome. 333.
I should talk actually about some solutions. There were some solutions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a group called World Shelters that came to us and asked for a grant to do temporary tent-like structures with composting toilets. And what intrigued us about this was not the actual design of the structure, although that it was very green and made sense. What intrigued us about it was that they wanted to do something that you called neighborhood clusters. They wanted to ask residents to allow them to put these sort of tent camping-type communities on two or three lots per block, and then to bring volunteers in along with the residents themselves to rebuild that block house by house. And as the houses got rebuilt, eventually moving the volunteers into that housing while they went and did another block. And so it didn't matter the structure. You could have done this with FEMA trailers. You could have said, okay, we're going to have two FEMA trailers on this block. We're going to get some volunteers back, or we're going to have some kind of temporary Quonset hut, whatever you want to do. We're going to get some volunteers here, we're going to get some residents here, and we're going to rebuild this block. And as you get those houses up and running, you have sort of a three-month rental period where they can house volunteers to build other houses. And eventually you're going to get the neighborhood back. And the good thing about that is that you keep residents in the communities where they live and work. It means their children can be around their friends. It means that they can begin to piece together their work life if they worked in an office in that community. And all of that speeds the recovery. You can begin to think about alternate structures for schools. You bring people back. In New Orleans, people were all thrown, literally scattered all over the country. And many of them are still flying back every 3 months to their properties to try and figure out how to rebuild. It's just been devastating for that economy, and it wasn't a strong economy to begin with.
Let me just take a second here to reintroduce the guest. We're talking with Kate Storer. She's the managing director. She's the co-founder of Architecture for Humanity. This is a nonprofit organization which started in 1999 by Kate Storer, and she's a journalist, and her partner, Cameron Sinclair, who is an architect. It was started back in 1999 to promote architecture and design solutions to global social and humanitarian crisis. And as she explained, the first thing was they were watching television one night and saw a story about Kosovo, and Cameron and said, well, this is an architectural issue, and said, I should design something for this. And then that led to this design competition to design structures to provide some transitional housing for people in Kosovo. And it's really grown from there to the point where they have now been involved in projects all over the world, including after the tsunami of 2004 in South Asia and Hurricane Katrina. If you'd like to find out more about Architecture for Humanity, go to their website, which is www.architectureforhumanity.org. And, of course, questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think
I'd like to talk about a question that was on the a design that was on the flip side of that. So we have these sort of really low-end tent structures. On the flip side of that, you may have heard about an idea called the Katrina Cottage. And this was a sort of mini pre-manufactured home. It was about three rooms. I can't remember the name of the designer. I might look it up so I can tell people that the name of the designer. But they did a great job, and they designed this sort of pre-manufactured cottage. Problem was, and it became sort of clear in the first few months after they introduced this idea, that it was going to take them, first of all, a while to get the manufacturing online to produce enough of them to get the cost down to something that would be affordable to residents on the Gulf Coast. Most of the people in our community where we were working were making $26,000 a year or less. That's, you know, that is poverty line and below. There was no way that it made any sense for them to spend $40,000 on temporary housing. It was smarter to start to take that money and put it into building permanent housing for them. And that's indeed what happened. In fact, you know, people were presented the option of the Katrina Cottage. It was on sale at Lowe's and some other places. So you could purchase these things, but every single time, in every single disaster, people will make inevitably the smartest choice for them. And they didn't opt for this short-term solution. They waited it out. They waited it out. They stayed in with friends. They stayed with relatives. They stayed in FEMA trailers if they could get one. And they put that money into permanent housing. And that's something to remember. People actually don't want temporary housing. They want permanent housing. And if there's a way that you can spend resources doing transitional structures that can be turned into permanent housing, which was the intent of the Katrina Cottage, although there were some issues with it, then that's what you want to do. You don't want to create a barrier for people getting back home.
One of the things I think it's really interesting about this is that it seems to me to have natural connections to the fact that here in the United States, and I'm sure a lot of other places around the world, but certainly here in the United States, we have a tremendous demand, a tremendous need for affordable housing, and that what we really need is more and more people thinking about how we can build houses, individual houses for people that are functional, that are pleasant places to live, places that people would like to live, that are constructed in keeping sustainability and Green's principles in mind, and do all that in a way that you can get it to come in for you know, maybe something under $100,000. I know there are people who are doing that, but it seems like it's a great challenge. And I wonder whether you can, in fact, take some of the things that you learn from doing emergency and transitional housing and apply that to the idea of something that would be more permanent and insane, and also satisfy a lot of those other concerns.
Yeah, well, you know, I mentioned that we didn't do emergency and transitional housing after Katrina. What we did was we were talking to residents, and they had one sort of big question, which was, can I move home? Can I afford to move home? They're telling me I have to elevate my house. How much is that going to cost? Can I do this? Should I just sell? Right? And you can imagine what it feels like. And these are folks who, many of them, about 30% of them, inherited their homes. They had no intention of ever building a house. Most of them didn't know about construction. So answering that question was the first thing we had to do. And we ended up going out and doing property surveys and looking at, and this gets really technical and I don't want to bore your listeners, but we ended up looking at whether a house was, it came down to whether a house was more or less than 50% damaged, right? And this can be a very subjective thing, but on a blanket level, you can often at least divide it into three categories. You know, way over 50% damaged, this house is going to have to be destroyed and rebuilt anew. Much less than 50% damaged, we think if we redo the roof and rethink the windows and make some code changes, you're going to be fine. And this sort of gray area. And in the gray area, it really depended on how much the family wanted to maintain that property. And we had many families who did. So we ended up developing a program, we called it the Biloxi Model Home Program, that looked at building at elevation affordably, and we had a target of $115,000 per house, because we had to jack up the houses sometimes as much as 12 feet, which means that all the foundations had to be engineered. And this is challenging. This is really challenging. And to do that at even $115,000 proved impossible. I think we ended up getting it on average about $125,000 to $140,000. Not using volunteer labor, using general contractors. This would be the cost of the house. And we didn't succeed. And we had architects from all over the region. We had teams on the ground. But what we did learn how to do was to finance the houses. And that ended up being the secret. It's unreasonable to say we need to cut the construction costs. There's a point where you're just, you know, throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I look around at some of the building in America today and I say, gosh, if you had just spent $10,000, $20,000, this building would gain in equity. Your neighborhood would gain in equity. You would make that back over the life of the building, which is 50 to 100 years. When you think about it that way, you have to sort of stop and recalculate. Maybe being cheap on the front end isn't the way we should be thinking about design and construction. Maybe what we need to be thinking about is how do we subsidize design and construction for low-income housing so that we're building market-rate houses that anyone would want to live in and that anyone would want to buy, that will gain in value over time, that will build the equity of the community, and that future generations are going to want to live in. Because that actually is the end goal, is to pass on a community to the next generation. So that's my take on it. And obviously, I am a little biased on the design side, but I really honestly think that cheap and shoddy construction is what makes for cheap and shoddy neighborhoods and all of the systemic issues that come along with that. People don't want to invest in neighborhoods that aren't going to grow in value and build equity.
Let's talk with another caller, somebody in the community of Belgium, not that far away from us here. not the country, but the town. It's line number four. Hello.
Hello. A couple concepts came up to me, but first, the one I really wanted to have your guest address is that tragedies happen all the time. I mean, constantly there's a problem someplace in the world. Now we always send tents to these places or something that's very temporary. Why doesn't somebody think along the lines of, you know, have something that they always send from place to place to place? Obviously, it'd have to have very durable structure, but it would be reused so many times, it would become green.
Yeah. In theory, I think that's a wonderful idea. We haven't found the design that does that. What tends to happen, and tents are the worst, they degrade almost right away. Most tents actually are made out of canvas until recently, and they were degrading before they even made it to the site. So tents don't hold up to reuse.
Exactly.
We've tested out other structures. We had the GV shelters that I was talking to you about, and we had World Shelters, and there was actually a beautiful project that's in the book that we profiled and designed like you give a damn that used basic cement block and wood and built transitional structures that were then sort of taken apart and repurposed and built into homes. And that almost worked. But the wear and tear on the structure in that first 6 months of high use tends to degrade the materials so that they're structurally, and plus the materials are exposed to the elements in a way that they may not if they were in a normal building where you have the building envelope protecting them. But it tends to wear the materials down, and it becomes very difficult to reuse structures. Also, people tend to, they own them, right? I mean, they're living in them for 6 months. You see this, right? You can walk into any college dorm room. You know what I'm talking about. There's posters all over the wall. There's holes everywhere. They own them. They take them over. They put speaker wiring in them. And I'm not kidding. We've gone into camps, and you see folks, this is the only thing that they have, and they've wired up a radio, or they've wired up a CD player, right? And as a result, you know, they're painted blue, they have curtain rods nailed into them, and people have been living in them for 6 months, and it's hard to repurpose them. They are owned. So
What I was getting at, ma'am, though, is your concept you spoke about where a few individuals would move into a community and take that community and start rebuilding it. This is exactly what I'm talking about. This initial few people, they would have the home, essentially a bomb shelter, something they could not destroy, use it as housing, get the people of the community, just like you said, going, and then move this structure on.
You know what? You have actually a great idea. In fact, you've hit the nail on the head. What actually happens, we talk about emergency structure a lot, but what actually happens after a disaster is that in the first few days, people really are struggling, but immediately they begin to repurpose the kinds of structures you're talking about, banks, schools, churches, these sort of indestructible structures that tend to survive calamity and use them as housing. And actually, after the tsunami, you found that people were sort of moving slightly inland and moving into these kinds of schools and other communities, civic centers, that kind of thing. And many, many were camping there and living in large groups there. Same thing happened on the Gulf Coast. Residents didn't come back, but the thousands and thousands of volunteers who came down immediately after the storm were living in schools and churches. So, you know, I think we don't want to dismiss the fact that often structures do survive. And maybe what we need to think about is how do we repurpose those surviving structures better. One of the things that happened after Katrina is that we had to build outdoor toilets and showers, composting toilets and showers, for some of the volunteer structures because they only, you know, as a church, they had four bathroom stalls. They weren't equipped to have 100 volunteers brushing their teeth in the morning, much less anything else. So you can think, if you were in on site and you were on the ground, there are any number of creative ways, and they're probably situation specific, that you can shelter people and house people after a disaster that are going to be faster than shipping in some pre-manufactured, you know, kit of parts at the end of the day. Faster, cheaper, and probably accommodate more people.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, thank you. And I suppose that getting the local people involved to the extent that they can is important, too, so that they feel that their ideas are considered, their needs are considered, they have some sort of stake in that because they're involved in making it.
Yeah, it's a balance. I think immediately after the storm, to put a rough number on it, let's say the first 2 months, people are grieving, actually. They've lost family members, maybe. They've lost their home. They actually don't, they want help. They need help. And they don't, and there is a, I call it decision-making freeze, you know. If you're dealing with the fact that your father died or your spouse died, that you don't have a job, you don't have a house, asking somebody, you know, where they want the main road of the, whether they want the railroad tracks to go through the town again, or whether they want to build a bakery, or whether they want, how they want their housing to look. They're not there. They are not there. And the unfortunate thing is that so often these decisions are made immediately after a storm, construction season begins, people are building, the urban planning has been redone, even though there was an existing infrastructure that, you know, many people had a stake in. And by the time that the community catches up with the decision-making, it's too far down the line for them to participate meaningfully. So when we work in post-disaster reconstruction, we try and leave that grace period for, first of all, communities to get back on their feet enough that they can meaningfully make decisions. You don't have to do urban planning a month or 2 months after the disaster. It's not meaningful. What you do have to do is help communities piece together the basic infrastructure. Street signs, incredibly important. In Sri Lanka, we did transitional schools. We just built very simple open-air classrooms with water reclamation, helped to allow parents to put their kids back in school and focus on getting their lives up and running again. So, you know, I know that's not a simple answer, but it is a very difficult process, and you have to understand where people are coming from and work sort of with them. A lot of that is doing things that maybe aren't necessarily architectural in the beginning. But afterwards, you can then begin to have a really meaningful conversation with somebody who sees you as a partner about how they envision their community. And you can begin to have a grassroots planning process that happens, I don't want to say organically, but you're sort of facilitating a more natural process with people who are there in mind, body, and spirit. You know?
Let me just quickly, because we have about 10 minutes left, introduce again the guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Kate Storr. She is the managing director, the co-founder of Architecture for Humanity. It's a nonprofit organization. She started it in 1999 with her partner, Cameron Sinclair, who's an architect. The idea was to promote architectural and design solutions to global social and humanitarian crises. They started this when they were living in New York. Now they're in San Francisco. And it has certainly grown over time. They've been involved in projects all around the world, including, as we mentioned, the reconstruction after Hurricane Katrina. They've also been involved in doing some work after the Asian tsunami of 2004, and to say a number of places around the world. If you're interested in finding out more about the organization, go to their website, which is www.architectureforhumanity.org, and that also would be a way that you could get a hold of the book that I've mentioned a couple of times that she edited, co-edited. It's titled Design Like You Give a Damn, Architectural Responses to Humanitarian Crisis, and here you can actually see examples of various kinds of shelters that people have designed and built around the world to provide emergency transitional housing and to deal with other kinds of needs that people have, and it's really very interesting. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, and this is someone in Herrick. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Here in this part of the country, I can build a nice habitable house for $10,000. Now, it's not going to be a three-bedroom house, and it's not going to be 2,000 square feet, but what I see a lot is that zoning ordinances and local regulations prohibit the building of smaller houses. Have you ran into that, and how do you deal with those sorts of situations?
Gosh, I haven't run into zoning ordinances that prevent smaller houses. In fact, usually there's open space ordinances that actually prevent you from building bigger houses, but it is dependent on where you are in the country, so I can't really comment on that, but I can tell you a funny story. We worked with a client on the Gulf Coast. We do sometimes after a disaster small sort of projects to keep families going, and one of the things came up was we had a family who was doing laundry, and they had to go an hour to do laundry. There was no laundry facility anywhere near Waveland, Mississippi. And so we thought, okay, well, we can not only help this family get back by building a secondary shelter that attaches to their FEMA unit that would be a laundry room, but they can also sort of rent that laundry room out to other people sort of coming into the community who needed to do laundry and make a little money and help them get back on their feet, right? So we went and we designed this, let's call it 200 square foot structure, right? And we went into the permitting department. We said, you know, we have this, because we're Architecture for Humanity, we're not going to do it without getting permitting, permission, right? So we went into the building department. We said, we've got this 200-square-foot structure, and it's a temporary structure, and it has a wheelchair ramp and allows this this woman and her daughter to access their trailer and do laundry, and it's temporary. And they said, that's great. You're in a flood zone, and it needs to be elevated 12 feet. So we said, okay, but you understand this is temporary, and it's only 200 square meters. And so if you do a wheelchair ramp, it would literally have to wrap around the house 8 times to create the sort of grade that you need for a wheelchair ramp and have it elevated up to 12 feet, and this is going to be ridiculous. And they said, yes, but that's the way it is. So we said, okay, fine. We built a model, and we had this model of this sort of 200-square-foot laundry room surrounded by what had to have been, like, 500 feet of wheelchair ramp that wrapped around it like this cone. Came back to the building code department and said, well, see, here's what we would be required to build for this temporary structure that's only going to be here for a few months, and really we're just trying to get this poor woman access to laundry, and you can see how she can't really ride up this crazy cyclone to get to her laundry room. And they finally conceded. But that's, you know, that's where sometimes building departments just need to see what the effect of their code is, particularly after disaster.
Well, and around here, it seems that we have a lot of small families, either individuals living alone, older people, or very young couples starting out without any kids. And a lot of the rules in this area require a building for a 3-bedroom house and everything that would go along with that. And they also require a certain square footage. Where, you know, an older gentleman living alone might be just perfectly overjoyed to have a 600-square-foot house or a 500-square-foot house and think that's entirely too much to keep up with. A lot of the smaller communities are requiring 1,000 feet or more. And, of course, lots of communities in this area require that it be a 3-bedroom structure.
And actually, there's a movement afoot to do. There's a movement afoot to do. They're called granny flats. It's allowing people to do smaller units on their property, so that you could have an elderly person who remains on their property, but they live in a smaller unit, and maybe family members live in the larger house, or they rent that larger house out and have some income. And you're right that many communities prevent, especially that kind of building, which is a shame. We need that kind of fabric. We need that kind of grit in our neighborhoods. We need those kinds of options for housing in our neighborhoods if we want to keep folks in their communities.
I think we need the starter ability. It used to be quite common for a young couple
right.
to buy
granny flats are great starter homes. They're great starter homes, too. But, you know, I want to talk about something else before we run out of time here. We talked about FEMA trailers and how there's formaldehyde in them. And we're talking a lot about disaster reconstruction, which makes us sound like ambulance chasers, and we're really honestly not. If you go to our website, we do a huge amount of development work that doesn't have to do with disaster. But the interesting thing about the FEMA trailer issue is watching these families complain about the formaldehyde and the health effects of that. Well, you know what? We have portable classrooms all over this country, and they are nothing but trailers slightly larger. So we have kids who are, then this isn't temporary, these are permanent structures. And they're in these portable classrooms all over this country, 6 million of them essentially spending the better part of their day in what is designed in the same way as a FEMA trailer. They have headaches, they have nausea, they complain, they have difficulty learning, the ventilation is poor. I mean, you can imagine all these things. So I think that we need to think about some of the ways that we're building temporary spaces that are actually permanent, and portable classrooms are one of them. We're starting a design competition, actually, that anyone can enter. It's hosted on the Open Architecture Network, which is an open source website we started to begin to catalog design solutions. And it launches in September. So if people are interested in these kinds of problems, please visit www.openarchitecturenetwork.org or visit our site and get involved. We really want people to start thinking about about portable classrooms. I think it's outrageous that we have children learning in these environments, and it's unnecessary. Sorry, I got on my high horse.
That's okay. We're coming
but
down.
But I think it's really important issue. I mean, we think about FEMA trailers, but people are living in those for, it's been longer than a year, but they're temporary. Portable classrooms aren't temporary. You know, our kids are living in boxes that have very poor ventilation and are gas off gassing every day. We can do something about this.
Well, it gets back to the need, and I'm sure that there's a need not just in the United States to have functional structures of various kinds, places for people to live, schools, other kinds of public buildings, community centers, and so forth that can be built affordably in a green way and be structures that at least should have a fairly long life. I mean, you know, maybe they might not be there for 100 years, but they're more than just temporary structures. And trying to figure out how you do that seems to be a great challenge, but it's something that there's a lot of designers and architects around the world clearly who are thinking about that very thing. And not just, as you say, this is not what some of what you've done has to do with disaster response, but others just it has to do with community development.
Yeah, exactly. We've been looking at ways that you can pair HIV/AIDS education with sports facilities. So you might have a health clinic embedded inside a sports facility. We've been looking at doing digital inclusion centers where you think about having a business incubator type space, whether it's a chocolate factory in Ecuador or a medical clinic or just an internet cafe, and then you have use that facility to wire or network the entire community, and we partnered with AMD on that. So I think that it's exciting for us to suddenly see this movement of architects and designers and what I call design advocates, which is people like you who care about what is happening to our world. I mean, the built environment releases about 50% of the carbon gases, 50%. And we're talking mostly about cars. That's what you hear about. But that's not what's releasing the CO2s. It's our buildings. It's their consumption of energy and power and air conditioning. It's their material use. It's the way that they create waste. So we need to start thinking about building more sustainably, and especially for those living on less than a dollar a day, because that is where the building is happening in the world. It's not happening in cities like New York. Those cities have been built. It's happening in cities like Mumbai, in Nairobi, Kenya. I mean, these are the cities of tomorrow. And if we're not thinking about building them more sustainably and thinking about alternative energy sources for the way that we power our cities, then we really aren't giving back to the next generation. And we need to start thinking about it immediately. I mean, the future is not looking optimistic for those of us who are looking at how cities are being built.
Well, for folks who would like to read more about these subjects and about the organization here we've been talking about, you go to their website. This is Architecture for Humanity. So it's www.architectureforhumanity.org. They're based in San Francisco. Our guest, Kate Storr, she is the co-founder and the managing director. And thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
No, thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates now has 4 area locations, including the Oasis in the lower level of the Illini Union.
I'm Tom Rogers. It's 11:59. Coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, I'll be talking with Ron Yates. He's the dean of the College of Media here at the University of Illinois. We'll be talking about this year's presidential campaign and how the media is covering it. The question, is it fair? Right now, let's take a look at the markets where the corn and soybean futures have been trading a little bit higher following as the crude oil and gold markets climb and the dollar declined against the euro. But wheat took a turn downward after profit-taking and some news that Iraq bypassed U.S. wheat in favor of Russian wheat as it had a tender. The quotes right now in Kansas City have December wheat down 19.5 cents now at $7.62 a bushel. March at $7.80, down 22. D-sweet in Chicago right now is at $7.30 a bushel, down 20.5. March at $7.55, down 15.25. December corn at $5.62.5, up 2.25 cents.